I'm Stefan Spencer, founder and president of interactive agency NetConcepts and senior contributor at MarketingProfs.com. Today we have with us Doug Kay, producer of IT Conversations. IT Conversations, I have to say, is a fabulous website, great place to find all sorts of thought leadership and all in form of audio downloads. Doug, thank you very much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Let's start off by just if you could tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to run this wonderful website, itconversations.com.
Well, I had a previous lifetime career in the motion picture business. I was an audio engineer, but I spent the last 26 years in the IT world, so I've had a chance to combine those. I was working as a consultant recently, writing a couple of books, and for the second book, I recorded interviews over the phone with some experts on the topic I was writing about. And in that process, I realized that these experts would always know much more about the subject than I would, and as an author, I was just getting in the way. So I wondered if it would be possible to go back and re-record those interviews and put them on the web so that people who would be interested could just listen directly to the experts. And that's what I did, and that became IT Conversations.
Great. And so this website, IT Conversations, is it an online business? Is it a labor of love? What exactly is that site for you?
Well, that's a good question. It is an online business, and it is a labor of love in that for the past 20 months or so, I've built it and run it, paying all the expenses myself. However, later in this quarter, we're in the first quarter of 2005, I will be turning on the sponsorship model, and so we do have some sponsors already lined up. It's going to be based the business model will be similar to public radio, and that is the majority of the funding will come from underwriters, and a smaller amount will come from listeners. It will be listener-supported, in the sense, basically based on contributions. And so far we've proven that it does work because we have a fairly passionate audience who feels quite willing and wanting to contribute.
Mm-hmm. So what exactly is podcasting for the uninitiated, and what is its significance for marketers particularly?
Yeah, podcasting is unfortunately very simple at one point and very confusing at the other. One way to look at it is to think that it is really portable TV, portable TiVo for audio. And what that means is, if you think about TiVo, it's number one, it's time shifted. That means you're not listening to real time. You're essentially putting programs into a recording device and listening to them later. And in this case, it's also mobile, and that's where the pod comes from. It's iPod or other MP3 players. And the concept is that people produce audio content, it's delivered over the internet, and it goes all the way into this portable device so that when you get up in the morning, you can pick up your iPod or other device, walk out the door, and on this device you have received the programming that you subscribe to. That would be different programs, radio programs or interviews or whatever it is that the podcasters are producing. That's the essence of podcasting. Now, you asked about the marketing opportunity. I guess that's the big question here today, and there are really two opportunities for marketers. One is people can produce their own podcast. It's not that difficult. And so there will be many opportunities for people to produce audio content and then distribute it. And the other opportunity for marketers is to act as sponsors or underwriters of existing podcasts.
Okay. So now you are a real pioneer in the area of podcasting. You were one of the very early podcasters out there. How did you, when exactly did you get started with it? How many other podcasters were out there when you started in the podcasting space, and how many are there now?
Well, I started in May or June of 2003, so nearly 2 years ago. And at that point, the concept and the name podcasting did not exist whatsoever. There has been audio on the internet for nearly a decade now, so we've always been able to download audio files. Certainly, MP3s, you know, with all the Napster and Kazaa and everything, have been available for a long time. And there's been spoken content available in that way as well. So I put out the content nearly 2 years ago, but there were two big things that happened, and they were technological. probably more of interest to the techies than anything else. The first was the concept that you could subscribe, so that rather than go out and discover an audio file, that you could say there's going to be a series of these files, and I'm going to establish a subscription to this, and that subscription uses a technology called RSS, which is typically really simple syndication is what that stands for. So the idea that you could attach audio to a subscription, that really came out it really became important, I would say, in the summer of 2004. That was number one. But even then, the content was delivered only as far as your personal computer or Macintosh, your laptop or your desktop machine. The final step was the creation of this script, if you will, a little piece of code that automated the delivery from the desktop or laptop into the player, so that rather than receiving it on your computer and then having to transfer it to the player, it went all the way. And you now get end-to-end delivery. You get it all the way from the producer of the content, the publisher, that is, all the way to the playback device. That's pretty cool.
That is very cool. So that's the iPodder software and others of its ilk. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And who invented this iPodder software?
Well, the very first script was written by Adam Curry of MTV fame. And, of course, Adam is getting all the press, which is great because he's a terrific spokesman for the podcasting movement. RSS was developed by Dave Weiner, who's responsible for, in many ways, the creation of blogging and RSS as well. The name podcasting was actually invented by Ben Hammersley, a journalist who came out with that about a year ago. I think it was February or March 2004. But Adam wrote that little piece of code. It wasn't very sophisticated. It was really to solve his personal problem. He was just getting tired of transferring audio by hand into his iPod. He says, why can't I just automate this? So he wrote the script, threw it out there for the public domain, in the public domain, and people latched onto this and started writing much better quality tools.
So Adam Curry, he was actually a video DJ for MTV back in the 80s, is that right?
I'm going to guess it's 80s. I lose track of time, but that sounds about right, late 80s, hopefully.
Wow, what a transition. Now he's a leading podcaster. Amazing.
Adam's a very technical guy. He doesn't admit to that, but he started a number of Internet-based businesses that had a high technology component. He's been involved with the Internet from the very beginning, so he's sort of been a background pioneer all along. He's also a great guy.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of great guys and great people that are out there podcasting, could you give me some examples, and for our listeners here, some examples of some great podcasts or podcasters that you listen to, particularly ones that are on a marketing tactic?
Yeah, that's interesting.
On a marketing level.
I spend so much time in the studio that I'm ashamed I don't get a chance to listen much. I'm taking a vacation for the next couple of weeks. I'm taking my iPod with me and catch up on some of these podcasts I haven't heard. But to give you an idea of the range of what's out there, not so much in the marketing domain, but I would say the majority of podcasts are like blogs, and that is that they are produced by individuals. The technical quality is relatively low, but their personal expression, it could be as mundane as, hey, I woke up this morning, brushed my teeth, and kicked the dog, or something like that. And some of them are popular, some of them are not, some of them will be around for a long time, most of them will disappear. But as you sort of move up the scale of sophistication, you find a tremendous number, my guess is that there are thousands and thousands of podcasts already. One of my favorites is called... I think it's called Real Reviews. I'm sorry I don't have the right to the name, but we can get you the URL after this. And it's Michael Gohagan who does some very high-quality, personalized movie reviews. And these are terrific. These are not of contemporary movies, usually, but movies that you can rent. And Michael's a passionate movie lover, and his reviews are first rate. We've got podcasts that are out there about PR, about marketing, about business models. None of them really coming to my mind at the top of, really giving the actual names of these. But again, they're easy to track down.
Mm-hmm.
Everything,
and those would be tracked on, where would you track and find these sorts of podcasts?
Good question. There are two good sources. One is iPodder.org. iPodder.org is a dynamically generated directory, in which case you can find a lot of things there, dynamically meaning that there are people always contributing to this in a semi-automated manner. And the other way to do it is if you download and install one of these iPodder clients, like iPodder or iPodder X or one of the other products, they all link into the directories as well. So without even leaving that software, you can go in and subscribe to them. Those are probably the two easiest ways to find out what's out there. And a lot of the shows, Adam Curry, for example, does his own show called The Daily Source Code. And one of the things that Adam does is frequently find new podcasts. But if you want to find them particular to a particular to an interest, let's say you're interested in marketing or public relations, probably the best thing is just to use Google and go in and put in marketing podcast or public relations podcast, because all of these podcasts are related to a website somehow.
Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago this idea of sophistication of podcasting and how you can have varying levels of professional sort of production of these podcasts. Blogs would be one example, interviews, roundtable discussions, lots of different things you could do at different levels of sophistication. What do you think is, how do you think this is all going to shake out or shake up, I suppose, in the near medium term, as far as who are going to end up on the top, which types of podcasts are going to become the most popular in your opinion, and which ones are going to be the most able to be monetized?
Well, those are probably two different questions. Let's take them separately. The first is what's the most popular, because the reason that they're separate questions is because I think a lot of podcasts will be popular but have no revenue basis, and there will be others that are, in fact, at the other extreme, there will be very special interests, but because they appeal to a special interest, they actually have more revenue potential. So if you look at there might be some, for example, that are very popular because they're personality-based. Like, again, a lot of people listen to Adam Curry. He's not talking about a detailed technical subject. He's, almost a lifestyle, if you will. Adam could at some point monetize that by bringing in sponsors. I don't know if he intends to or not. But, again, it's a very has very high production values because of Adam's background. So there will be a lot of those that will be of broad interest. But then at the other extreme, you'll have podcasts for doctors. You'll have podcasts for people with specific hobbies and interests. Those might be very good in terms of attracting sponsors who have something to sell into those marketplaces. Those could be very effective as well. And if you look at your life and I look at my life, we're very many different people all in one, aren't we? We have our professional interests. We have our personal interests. And just as we read and watch television on a wide range of subjects, we're likely to do that in podcasting as well. You know, I may read the New York Times. I may also read a book on technology. I may read another book on airplanes. And so we'll have multiple personalities, if you will, when it comes to consuming content.
So actually, blogger, podcasters, people who conduct professional interviews, roundtable discussions, all these sorts of things could actually all be quite successful and popular on the Internet in the future.
I think not only will you see, if you think of the formats in radio, there are very few radio formats. There's the music format, and there's the talk format, and then there's the interview. There's music, news, talk, and interview. Those are the four primary radio formats, aren't they? In podcasting, we have more. For example, IT Conversations on our site, we have a very large number of simply conference presentations where we or others have recorded conferences, presentations by experts of a variety of topics, and we put those online. And you couldn't do that on radio. It's just not cost-effective because bandwidth is scarce. It's a very precious commodity, whereas in podcasting, bandwidth is essentially free. So our ability to narrowcast, to go out and put out specialized content where the audience might in fact be small, is terrific.
Now, you mentioned bandwidth is essentially free, but to do a real a proper podcast, you really need to invest in good equipment. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, there are certainly costs, but, you know, I've done the math for others who asked me the question. You know, the cost to deliver a one-hour podcast can be as low as 1 to 2 cents to deliver a one-hour podcast to one individual. That's fairly cheap. Now, it certainly is cheap when you're delivering it to just 100 people. When you're delivering it to 1 million people, you know, now you're looking at $10,000 to distribute that. But when you have an audience of 1 million, then, of course, you have a very different business model as well. But, yes, it does require some investment. Some of the podcasts out today are being done on produced on laptops with built-in microphones and no additional hardware whatsoever, even free software. So that's the low end. Here at IT Conversations, I'm talking to you from Studio 2. I look over, I see a rack of equipment that's worth about $25,000. So those are the two extremes probably.
So you invested quite a lot of money in equipment, $25,000. That's a significant investment. So did you make that investment going through the numbers and figuring this is going to generate a return, and part of this return is because of podcasting, or was podcasting not part of this? Was this too long ago that you made this investment? Tell me a bit about your thinking on that.
Yeah, actually, the problem is that I have a weakness for audio content, for audio quality. So in order to solve the audio problems and continuing to prove the quality on an ongoing basis, I keep buying more and more equipment. It's a real bad habit. And the majority of the equipment was in here before the podcasting phenomenon really took off. Most of the equipment that I've bought, or most of the dollars that I've spent, I should say, are with regard to conducting really high-quality phone interviews. I have ISDN lines into the studio. I have specialized equipment for recording over ISDN. I also have the equipment that's essentially the same as what you'd find in a radio station, so that I can do direct studio-to-studio links. So I can have someone go to a studio in New York or Chicago and interview them over the phone as though they were literally right here in front of me. So anyway, that's that. And then just ongoing stuff. Plus, I have a complete mobile rig because I don't do so much anymore, but I used to go to conferences and do the recording myself, as well as doing some live streams from those conferences. But over time, as podcasting has become more important, the value of doing live streaming has gone down quite a bit. The traffic that I get from people who download versus listen live is tremendous. Maybe I would say when we go out and do a conference, we might might get 400 or 500 listeners, but we might get 50,000 listeners to the download.
So with all this expense of doing a professional podcast, professional interview, you'd need some serious sponsorship dollars coming in to help support that. What is your sponsorship model? What would somebody get for X amount of dollars if they signed up to be a sponsor with you? How'd that work?
Well, we're playing with a number of different opportunities. It's a real challenge, actually, but it looks like the way it's going to settle out is that the sponsors or underwriters are going to primarily get audio content at the intro and outro of the show, very similar, again, to public radio. So there will be an underwriting message at the beginning, another underwriting message at the end. A couple of reasons for this. One is there will also be some website content, but if you think about how I describe podcasting, you realize that a lot of people never go to the website anymore. So we have relatively little page view traffic compared to the audio listenership. And that's because people are subscribing, and they just pick up the iPod, and they don't even know what's on there until they listen to it. So audio spots are the primary manifestation of the advertising dollar. That's what we're going to see.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that's a somewhat similar to webcasts, in that the precious spot that an advertiser or a sponsor would want to get is at the beginning of the actual webcast, rather than on, let's say, the landing page where they've registered for the event or whatever. The real meat of it is during the webcast itself. A similar model applies here with podcasts.
Couple of differences that are very important for marketers in the way that podcasts and webcasts vary. The first is that in a webcast, a sponsor, it's very important to a sponsor typically to get registration information or at least demographic information. A sponsor of an event usually wants to come away with email addresses and hopefully demographics and certainly purchasing habits. You're not going to get that in podcasting because the podcasters are almost all anonymous, which is a real problem for anyone trying to sell advertising because I can't even provide demographics to my sponsors. And a lot of my sponsors are used to buying radio time, let's say. And they're saying, well, radio can give us numbers from Arbitron. Why can't you? Well, we just don't have the infrastructure to do that. That's the first thing. The other difference is that most webcasts are live events. You tune in at 11 o'clock Pacific, 2 o'clock Eastern, and you hear the expert live. Podcasting is explicitly not that. It's time-shifted delivery. Much larger audience. I mean, a successful webcast might have only 100 or 200 listeners, but to be successful podcast, you'd expect many more numbers because you have a long shelf life.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now, you mentioned RSS being difficult to actually track and pin down who's listening and who's subscribing and who's clicking and all that sort of stuff. I've heard of a couple of services and had a look at a couple of them. One's called Simple Feed, and another one is called FeedBurner. And both of them can give you numbers around number of subscribers and click-throughs if you click on the links and those sorts of things. So how could you actually track, or is it even possible, using personalized URLs with click tracking in them and all that sort of stuff? Is there a way, do you think, to apply this sort of RSS tracking to podcast tracking, or is it just not even possible?
Well, there are things that are possible. We've been running tests with FeedBurner as well. I think it's a great service. There's currently a bug in some of the podcasting software that's incompatible with FeedBurner, so we're sort of waiting for that, the fix of that bug to be distributed. But FeedBurner, the big advantage to us of FeedBurner is that it's third party, it's independent, so they can serve as an audit for our traffic. An advertiser doesn't have to trust our statistics, they can get them from an independent source. However, FeedBurner, they do have the ability to track clicks, and they can identify clicks up to a point, but unless there is a registration process, unless there's a mechanism by which we identify the user, we don't know who that user is. We can count how many unique listeners there are because we can do that by IP address, but we don't know who they are. Now, there will be people who insist on charging for content, and once you charge for content, then, of course, you must have a mechanism for authentication. And there are people who will be rolling out authentication models based on RSS, but they really don't exist today.
Interesting. Okay. Now, one thing I'd really like to get a handle on are what are some real horror stories or sorts of things where it'd just be an embarrassing moment or a hard lesson learned from the school of hard knocks. Maybe you could share some either hypothetical or real examples with our listeners.
Well, will you share some of yours with us too?
I will.
Well,
you first.
I'll tell you the first one. My very first interview. I went out with a laptop. I had some nice lavalier microphones. I had a little mixer. And I was going to record on the laptop, and I did record on the laptop. And it was a guy that I had worked hard to get for this interview. I went to his office. I did it in a conference room. At exactly 1 hour into an interview that was supposed to be an hour long, the laptop died, and I lost the entire interview. And that was hard lesson number one, which is I no longer record on a laptop, or if I do, it's not the only thing I record on. In fact, at this point, when I'm in the studio, I have three recorders running. I'm recording on a PC, I'm recording direct to a CD recorder, and I'm doing a backup on VHS audio, VHS hi-fi audio. So I'm typically running three recorders. In the field, I have at least two. So that was the best lesson. there are so many others. There are so many others that range from technological problems like that to content problems. I'm not sure what you're interested in.
How about one of each?
Okay. Well, that was the best technological one. I guess content-wise, I started out doing a lot of interviews, and I have some background in journalism and radio, but not a lot. And doing a good interview, as you know, is really hard. The thing that helped me the most was to listen to other good interviewers. Terry Gross on NPR, for example, I think is a very good interviewer. And just listening and trying to understand what these people were doing. Do your homework. If you're interviewing an author, my God, read the book. So many interviewers don't even read the books of the authors that they're interviewing. You've got to do that. Prepare a script in advance. Don't stick to it, but at least have all your questions lined up. Because when you go to interview someone, some people will talk naturally. They'll go on. Some will talk too long. Some will talk too short. And you have to be able to manage that without giving the sense that you're really interfering. Because when you're interviewing someone, remember, your audience wants to hear that person. They're not really interested in hearing you. If they're listening to you, then you're really, what are you? Are you a Rush Limbaugh? Are you a Howard Stern? Are you a Don Imus? I'm not sure. But most of the things that you and I do, the interviews are about the other person. So listening is very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I promised to share one of my horror stories, and I will. You know this horror story all too well because it happened with you. Our very first interview, my very first podcast, and that was you, Doug. And, of course, after I recorded our, I think, fabulous conversation, I listened back to the recording, and first of all, I could barely hear your own voice, and secondly, the coupler I had used to plug into the telephone handset had introduced noise. So between the two things, I could only hear my own voice and none of yours. So I had to sheepishly come back to you and beg you to re-record the interview with me when you graciously agreed. So thank you. So that's my horror story, but it was a very important lesson, just like your first lesson with the laptop. And I found another alternate way to do recorded phone interviews. I'm actually using a conference service as we speak and letting them do the hard work of getting the levels right and everything. It's just automatic. I don't use a telephone coupler at all, and having to worry about my voice being louder than the person at the other end of the line. So,
I mean, we accept a certain number of submissions from people anonymously. People will send me email or call me and say, hey, I want to record something or I have recorded something. It's really a terrific session, and I think it would be great for IT conversations. And I want to be as nice as possible, but I got to tell you, the majority of the recordings that we get are unusable. And there are really two keys. I'm not even talking about telephone because, as you've discovered, recording telephone interviews with good audio quality is extremely hard. And I think your solution with a conference call and a recording service is a great one. But if you're doing a live recording, there are really two things that are the most important. Number one, you must have microphones within 1 foot of the speaker. Do not even attempt to record a session by sticking a microphone in the middle of a room, even if it's a small room, and hope to pick up everybody. The audio quality will be very disappointing. So you either need to have one microphone for one speaker, or many microphones, or at least a microphone that you can move around. I recorded an event last night, for example, and I made a fool of myself during the question and answer period by running around and sticking microphones in people's faces and telling them that they had to start their question over again if they didn't wait for the microphone. But I've now listened to that recording, and after editing, it's going to be terrific. The second thing you have to remember is watch your levels. If you're recording anything live, if the levels are too high, it will distort. If the levels are too low, when you bring it up, you're just going to get noise. So those are the two things, microphone position and levels. Watch those things carefully, and then you can get good recordings.
What did you do as far as actual results or ROI or improved traffic, PR, readership, all that, once you've pulled in a kind of just basically bought into the whole concept of podcasting and went full tilt into it, I understand that you had significant traffic increases over a relatively short period of time. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, the traffic was growing steadily, but not super fast for the first year. And then there were two things that happened. The first was the podcast bubble, if you will. Mix my metaphors here. Podcasting has become one of those rising waters that lifts all ships. So just being associated with the podcasting movement has done quite a bit for the traffic, even though I don't really consider IT Conversations to be a podcast. It's really just audio on the net. But podcasting has done a lot because, as you suggested, people do consider me to be a podcasting pioneer. The second is that we had a couple of very high-profile events that the blogging community linked to quite a bit. There was a conference called GnomeDex, and we had two great speakers. One was Steve Wozniak of Apple fame, and the other was Will Wheaton. Will is an actor who was on the Star Trek Next Generation series, who was also an author and blogger. And both of these presentations were marvelous. And, of course, we had the exclusive audio on the net for those. There was another event held in Maine in 2004 called PopTech. And at PopTech, Malcolm Gladwell, the author, also who writes for the New Yorker, gave a terrific presentation, as did Thomas Barnett, formerly of the State Department. So these four recordings probably did more to increase the traffic than anything else other than the podcasting movement itself.
It's funny you mentioned Malcolm Gladwell. I'm quite a fan of him. His book, The Tipping Point, is one of my favorite business books, and now I've just gone to Amazon in the past week and purchased his brand new book, Blink. But I actually first found out about the IT Conversation site through a mention on the Boing Boing blog, which, for people that are into blogging, Boing Boing is one of the most popular blogs out there. And there was a mention of the Malcolm Gladwell presentation from PopTech at the itconversations.com site. That's how I found you. And I thought, wow, this is an incredible site. I was just amazed.
Well, and it even surprises me, if you go to Google and you search for Malcolm Gladwell, IT Conversations is the second entry in the list, the first being Malcolm's own site, I think. I'm not sure how that happened, but as you can imagine, we get quite a bit of traffic because Malcolm's quite a popular guy.
All right.
Hopefully we are helping him sell some books, too.
Hopefully, yes. So speaking of blogging and how that helped bring me to your site, how has blogging, in your opinion, brought a face and a personality to faceless corporate entities, and how do you see podcasting extending that even further?
Good question. I think in the case of blogging, organizations are just now figuring that out. You know, there have been a few blogging business conferences, and I think you know, some of the most visible example is probably Robert Scoble, who was a blogger before he was hired by Microsoft, and Robert has continued in that role to be Microsoft's best-known blogger. Jonathan Schwartz, who is the president of Sun Microsystems, has his own blog, and that's quite remarkable, too, if you think about it. And so organizations are trying to understand that because, you know, the typical situation is the marketing department wants to be a funnel or a bottleneck to control corporate communications. The whole MarCom concept is based on that. And when you start having individuals within the organization communicating directly with the public, that sort of blows that model out of the water. So people are just getting started with that. When it comes to podcasting, I think we're farther from the answer because it's so new. I think what people in marketing will first think of when they think of audio is the webcast model, which we're all so familiar with. And moving into a podcasting model is going to take a bit of work for people to, A, understand what it is, and then, B, figure out how to best utilize it for their purposes.
How do you think a business should begin to experiment or dabble in podcasting?
Good question, which means I don't really have the answer. I would say I think The biggest difference about podcasts is the subscription model. Okay, I mean, it's one thing to put out your webcast. Each webcast is sort of a unique presentation. You do a webcast, and then maybe you do another. You might even have a weekly series, but people don't typically subscribe to it. So you need to get behind the concept of a subscription where people are going to come back on a regular basis. Now, it doesn't need to be regularly scheduled. Because people get content as it's created, you don't need to have a weekly podcast. It can be only when there's something worth saying. I had an interesting experience just with blogging the other day, and this could be extended into podcasting. And in fact, it was with a company we just mentioned, which was FeedBurner. I subscribed to an RSS feed from FeedBurner. There's no audio, it's just text. But through this link, FeedBurner puts out customer service announcements. For example, they were experiencing not an outage, but a degradation of performance, and they sent out this message. And I'm sitting here at my desktop, and this message comes in, and it's much better than email because there's no spam in RSS. But I got a message that said, you know, we're having a little bit of problem. We hope to have it fixed in a few hours. This was brilliant for me because in this case, I had not experienced the outage myself. But had I, I would, you know, just before I had picked up the phone to call them about a problem or I sent them email, I get a proactive message from them. And this is marvelous from the point of view of customer relations. So I would look to do that same type of thing with podcasting, which is to say, let me go out and subscribe to the podcast feeds for the people I do business with and let them put into podcast form new information, something where the audio medium is important to me. For example, let's say I work with a company that provides a technology to me. Well, I might want to listen to their guru of that technology explain to me about how to use it and what kind of changes are coming in their product line. And audio can be an extremely effective mechanism for doing that, especially if I'm in a situation where I can listen while I commute or exercise, which, of course, is a big opportunity for audio. So that's the kind of thing I'd be looking for.
Mm-hmm. And that FeedBurner example was excellent in that it wasn't a blog that has RSS that then goes to podcasting, because a lot of companies are scared of being that human and that fallible in a blog or that uncensored, and this is a lot safer sort of approach. Just think of it as a customer service channel, a way of building a rapport and improving communication with your customers without having to just unleash that blogging beast. So that's quite good.
Yeah, and one of the things about a podcast is I think, just my guess, but I think most podcasts that come from corporate entities will have a bit of a structure to it. For example, a company might say, we're going to put our expert in technology, ABC, in front of a microphone and let him talk about our new features that are coming. That's different from going to a blogger and saying, we're going to turn you on and let you start blogging, you know, every day for the next years and write about whatever you want. So from the point of view of people who are cautious and conservative, which I don't recommend, by the way, but if people do have that approach, I think it's a little easier to control podcasting because you essentially do that. You make the formal commitment to put someone in front of a microphone one time and then another person the next time and so forth.
More palatable for the legal department.
Yeah. You know, let's face it, we all know that's going to be a problem.
Yeah. Well, do you have any closing comments that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, the only thing I can say is, boy, it is really early. The whole podcasting phenomenon at this point is less than 6 months old, which is remarkably short. The only reason that podcasting has become so important so fast, and when I say that, recognize that it has been covered by Fortune, Business Week, Newsweek, USA Today, ABC News, which is remarkable for something so young and that is at this point so geeky. The reason that that's happened is that it's really sprung out of the blogging community. And so all of the infrastructure for technology as well as the community around it was essentially all in place. So all we had to do was sort of put the final touches on and we had this thing called podcasting. So recognize that it's very early. The software is unsophisticated. It's not for everybody yet. I do believe podcasting has a very long and important future ahead of it, but do recognize it's early in the game.
Well, thank you very much, Doug. That was Doug Kay, founder and producer at IT Conversations. You can find them on the web at www.itconversations.com. And again, I particularly recommend you listen to the talk by Malcolm Gladwell from PopTech. This is Stefan Spencer, founder and president of NetConcepts, signing off. Thanks for listening.